In 1930, the United States had about 6.3 million farms. By 2000, 4.2 million farms had been plowed under, and the United States had only 2.1 million left. Some say the 27 million people who lived on those farms were deliberately forced out in a Stalin-like purge. Others say their loss was simply a consequence of a more efficient way of farming food. This leads one to ask, what did happen to all those farmers?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
You are tuned into the 504th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends at Ez, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jay Cruz on the boards. Hello, Jay.
Hey, how's it going?
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Folks, if you were to drive through the rural areas of the United States and the Americas, Canada, Mexico, United States, you would drive away at the maze, amazed at the ghosting of our heartland. Where there was the sound of people and communities and life, there is now the sound of the wind. What did happen to the 27 million people who lived there and the millions more who lived in Canada and in the millions more that lived in Mexico? Were they driven off the land as part of some deliberate economic plan, a Stalin-like purge, if you will? Or were they simply lost in the move to a more efficient way of growing food? And here to help us find an answer, by golly, we're going to go to Tom Pollock, who is up there in Canada. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Very good. Also, we have Cyril Vitomsky here in California. Hello, hello, Cyril. Go ahead, try it.
Hello, Michael.
You're there.
Hello, Tom.
Good.
Hi.
Tom, you're an organic farmer. You're also the author of The End of Food, right?
That's right.
Well, how does an organic farmer come to write a book about the end of food?
Well, I'm also a journalist. I've been an agriculture journalist for a number of years, a science journalist, covering agriculture as my specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And I've both covered it as a journalist and run farms of my own.
Well, the question that came to my mind is that why wouldn't you write a book, if you're an organic farmer, why wouldn't you write a book called The Beginning of Food?
Well, that might be true if you favor organics, but I'm not an expert at it. What I'm more worried about was the looming crisis that I saw coming.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when I looked through your book and I ran across a chapter that said that was entitled Stalin Rideau. And in that, I take it you really make the position that the elimination of so many small farmers here in the Americas, Canada, United States, and Mexico, could be compared to the purge of small farmers by Stalin in 1931 and 32. So you make that connection, and you say that it was actually a deliberate thing, correct?
I think it was in large part deliberate. It was a deliberate choice of large corporations which were trying to dominate the market, and the deliberate choice of several politicians, eventually of the Nixon administration, who were beholden to these corporations.
Okay, that's the position. Let's go to Cyril Vitomsky. I'd like to have the opportunity to introduce Cyril. I first met Cyril on the steps of this radio station here in Santa Cruz, California, it must have been about 12 years ago or something like that.
That would have been
1995, and Cyril was standing there right outside the front door, and he said, I have just defected from the Soviet Union, and I'm going to be a news talk host.
Well, that wasn't true, Michael.
Pretty close to the truth, Cyril. It was pretty close to the truth. I still remember the look in your eye and the hunger. And by golly, you became a news talk host. You host a program called the Embassy of the New World Order, and you do international affairs.
Correct.
Correct. And I take it you don't quite go along with the notion that the elimination of small farmers throughout the Americas was a deliberate act in the same sense that the elimination of small farmers by Stalin was a deliberate
act. Well, the comparison definitely is not... it's nice for a metaphorical play, but I don't think that there is anything even near that warrants a comparison. As for whether that's deliberate or not, it really depends on what do you mean by deliberate. Whether was there a one general grand plan? I don't think so. I don't think that there are any plans of that magnitude that could survive the time, especially across the borders, because I understand from haven't read your book in full, Tom. Just skimmed through that last night because Michael just gave it to me last night, specifically marking this article about Stalin's redux. And so I don't know the full details of the book, but I don't think that there is that much of a comparison, especially when you're talking about across lots of borders.
Okay, well, let's go to... I think this would be a great chance for a history lesson for everybody. And let's go back to 1930 to 1932. Tom, why don't you start us off? Stalin decided to get rid of what you call the kulaks. Why? Who are the kulaks, and why did Stalin decide to get rid of them?
Well, first of all, I'm not a professional historian, and I'm certainly not an expert on Russian history. But I did go to several sources in the library, mm-hmm. and read what people who are experts had to say. And they seem to be pretty authoritative.
Mm-hmm.
I read one book by, it was actually a colloquium, by Esther Kingston Mann and Tim Mixter on Russian agriculture from 1800 to 1921, which would have carried it into the beginning of the Soviet era.
Right.
And then I've read several articles on what happened in the Soviet era. But that doesn't make me an expert by any means.
Well, just
but
tell
from
us
what I understand, there was a deliberate purge of the small farming class in Russia. And the purge resulted in a famine, and roughly 10 million rural people died as a result.
Well, Cyril goes along with
well,
that.
Yeah. What happened in Russia or the Soviet Union definitely was deliberate. There's no question about that, because that was the part of communist ideology where the peasants were not supposed to be, eventually in the long run, alive. Was supposed to be replaced by agricultural workers, like industrial workers everywhere else, because that's
exactly the collectivization.
Correct. And so that definitely what happened there is no doubt a deliberate attempt.
What are kulaks, Cyril?
It's a Russian word for a fist. The person there are two explanations. One is that they were really rough people, and the second explanation is that they grab the stuff that they have in their fist and would not let go.
Why did Stalin want to get rid of them?
Because that's what happened in the Soviet Russia after 1917. The land was distributed by Lenin's government. The arable land was distributed between the peasant families based on the number of mouths in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time when collectivization started, so about 11, 12 years from then, we're talking about 28, 29, there was already a distinct difference between the people that worked hard and produced a lot, and because of that became wealthy, or wealthier than the your regular peasant lumpen that would that would run around bellyache about those capitalists and exploitators and wouldn't do anything.
So there the whole notion of equality for all wasn't quite working out in the fields.
Never.
So some people were getting far more wealthy than others.
Right.
So and these wealthy ones were called the kulaks.
Yes.
And why did Stalin want to get rid of them?
Well, because, you have to understand the nature of the communist state. The communist state requires abolition of a private property, including private property of arable land. There is no ownership of land, private ownership of agricultural land in the communist state, period.
That's right. And the farming enterprises were reorganized on an industrial model when they were collectivized.
Oh, and that's where we want to pick up when we come back. What about it out there? What do you think happened to the tens of millions who farmed the heartland of the Americas? Were they forced out in some Stalin-like purge, or were they simply replaced by a more efficient way of growing food? As you know, the food chain is media that talks with you, not at you. So pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-47-1980. We have Tom Pollock, the author of End of Food. We have Cyril Vitomsky, host of the Embassy of the New World Order Show. And we have you, 800-624-2665, 831-47-1980. Right back. Hey, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program right here on News Talk Radio. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. And today we're chewing up what happened to the farmers here in the Americas and kind of looking at that and seeing if there is a comparison that can be legitimately drawn between what happened to the farmers here in the Americas over the past 50 years and what happened to the farmers in the former Soviet Union when Joseph Stalin purged them in the early 1930s. Is there a comparison that can be made there? We're looking at a situation back in the 1930s where Stalin was looking to industrialize agriculture. Tom Pollock, author of The End of Food, what do you mean by that, industrialize agriculture?
Well, organize it on the same basis as you would organize a factory engaged in mass production. Instead of individual people making individual decisions, there's like almost a conveyor belt mentality applied. Also consolidating individual units into larger and larger units to the point where you, in some cases, just have one huge unit.
As Cyril, make sense?
Well, yeah, and the consolidation was a two-step process. First was collectivization into kolkhoz, which is collective farming. Where there was no owner other than the collective ownership of the farm. Think of it as United Airlines owning their own stock and nobody else, only employees owning the stock, nobody else owns the stock, provided that everybody understands that the government owns the land anyway and tells the kolkhoz what to do. Mm-hmm. And the second stage that has not been achieved until into the 70s, was the transition of those kolkhoz, collective farming, into sovkhoz, which was Soviet farm, where workers, where peasants did not really even exist. They were all agricultural workers that they did not depend in any way on their productivity. They depend, they received salary, just like a lathe operator in the factory in the Soviet Union would receive a salary, a base salary.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so yes, the same thing would
so
happen.
So I'm glad to hear you confirming my understanding of Soviet history, which is not all that profound.
Well, we're doing good. Then we got some agreement here. What happened when Stalin purged the kulaks, the successful small-scale farmers? Tom, what happened when Stalin came in and got rid of all of those successful small farmers?
Well, from what I understand, obviously, the first thing that happened is that the people who really understood agriculture and understood farming were wiped out. These were the people with the expert knowledge. The mere fact that they were the wealthiest farmers, the ones who made the most money at what they were doing, indicated that they really understood what they were doing. They were like a brain trust of agricultural experts. And when this group of farmers were wiped out, the knowledge base that the Soviets needed to continue producing decent crops was gone. And in place of that knowledgeable local farmer who really understood his land, knew what each acre on that land was like, whether it was, you know, he understood the how moist it was, right, when it was hot, when it was cold, how rich and productive a particular acre was, what crops grew best on it. When those persons were wiped out, they were replaced with a bunch of people who really didn't know much at all about agriculture.
And could care less.
And care even less, yeah.
Because their livelihood, their salaries were not dependent on whether they were growing anything decent, whether they were producing anything worthy.
Because it didn't matter.
And they had no interest in the land other than the fact that it earned them a salary, which would not go up or down depending on what they produced.
Correct.
And it wasn't theirs. They didn't possess it. They had no reason to be particularly interested in it. They were essentially just wage slaves.
Well, Cyril, what happened then to the agriculture of the Soviet Union?
Well, the agriculture collapsed dramatically. The Soviet, the Russia that was lauded to be the grain basket of Europe or Eastern Europe because of those Ukrainian topsoil areas just collapsed. And from then on, Russia was a net importer of grain, for example.
Yeah, the black earth areas were no longer producing.
Right. So some
of the richest farmland in the world is in the
right.
Ukraine there.
There is also, besides the fact that those people did not know what to do, they were also told what to do by people that by default never knew what to do. Like Khrushchev, for example. When Khrushchev came to the United States, he was so impressed with corn and the abundance of corn and the applications of corn. And so he came back and said, everybody, you plant corn. So everybody stopped planting rye, stopped planting wheat. They started planting corn, and that backfired because it wasn't an appropriate zone for corn.
So why didn't the industrialization work? I mean, Tom, you may kind of make the assertion that there was just too many variables in the microclimate nature of agriculture for an industrial...
Yeah, if there's one thing that you could give a middle initial to agriculture, it would be agriculture with a big V for variables. There's an almost infinite number of variables in running any farm. You have to be an entomologist, a soil scientist, an animal husbandry expert, a climatologist.
And it all has to be keyed toward where you're living right now.
Where you're living and knowing your local markets and knowing about transport costs and everything else. It's an extremely complex business, one of the most complex in the world. And I would say a successful farmer has enough knowledge in his or her bean to be roughly the equivalent of a doctorate.
Cyril, I've read that somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 million people died as a consequence of this.
That's just the famine, I think. You're referring to the famine of 33 in Ukraine. There was probably more overall in terms of production. You know, but, see, I don't think that industrialization by itself, and or if you compare it to what's happening in the United States or Canada, is the centralization.
Okay. Well, let me go to there. Let me introduce it by going here. Between 1930 and the year 2000, United States alone lost about 27 million people from farm country, and then many more millions were lost in Canada and Mexico as well. In the chapter on Stalin Rudeau in Tom Pollock's book, The End of Food, Tom, you use a quote by Wendell Berry that kind of introduces this whole notion. I'd like to read it. This from Wendell Berry. I remember during the 50s the outrage with which our political leaders spoke of the forced removal of the populations of villages in communist countries. I also remember that at the same time in Washington, the word on farming was get big or get out. The only difference is that of method. The force used by the communist was military. With us, it has been a free market, in quotes, in which the freest were the richest. In other words, what Stalin did in 2 years, the free market did in 70 years. And by using Wendell Berry's quote, Tom Pollock, you seem to be implying that Stalin in Russia and rich people in the Americas had the same objective, which were get rid of farmers. Is that where
you're going? In that respect, getting rid of the small farmer and rationalizing the industry on an industrial basis, yes. But first of all, you can't, and I don't pretend to say that you can call the two processes exactly alike. They aren't. One happened in 2 years, the other happened in 60 to 70 years.
Right.
And one was accomplished with very brutal and vicious motives, and the other was accomplished with what I call slow motion brutality. The one was a single dictator driving policy, and the other was what I would call an oligarchy of people with strong connections in Washington and Ottawa driving policy. So there are many differences, but when you look at the results are in many ways similar, and that's what was the point of my making that comparison.
Okay, we're going to come back with the response from Cyril Vitomsky, and we've got callers on the line, 800-624-2665, 831-4790. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We're talking about what happened with all the farmers. We're talking with Tom Pollock, author of The End of Food, Cyril Vitomsky, host of the Embassy of the New World Order radio program. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about what happened to all the farmers. Some 27 million disappeared here in the United States between the years of 1930 and 2000. And many more millions were disappeared from Canada and Mexico as well. And we're wondering if there's any comparison that can be drawn between the farmers that got disappeared by Joseph Stalin in the purges of 1930 to 33 there. And we've got Tom Pollock, who is the author of The End of Food, and we have Cyril Vitomsky, who is the host of the Embassy of New World Order radio program. Cyril, it's your turn respond to this notion that there was a connection.
Well, I don't think that there is. Well, the parallel, obviously, you can make the parallel, but the fundamental distinction and the fundamental difference between what's happening in the United States and Canada and what happened in the Soviet Russia at that time was the elimination of private property. The private property in the Soviet Union was totally eliminated. Ownership of land was not available. So you replace the people that work on land, that own the land and work on that land for profit. That's why they are always, as in the capitalist society, they would always go for increase in productivity. And you replace them with wage slaves, as sometimes people call it, although I don't particularly like that term. But and those people do not care about increased productivity because they get, no matter what, they get the same salary. And the United States, it is the parallel, I think, that we should make with the United States and all of this creation of those big farms and conglomerates is the parallel with other industries. So how is it that agriculture is different from other industries? Why it is okay and why is it good to have consolidation in terms of Ford, General Motors buying all the other companies, banks. We always
look what's happening to Ford and General Motors.
Well, that's another story. You know, that's welfare and healthcare. You know, uh-huh. they had to get into that business.
Well, let's go to Tom. Tom, can you respond to that? How is agriculture different than any other industries?
Well, there's a lot of differences. First, I'd like to get back to the private property comment there.
Go ahead.
What we've seen in North America is not eliminating private property, but eliminating private property for small operators and making it almost impossible for them to maintain their operations.
So they can have their land, but they can't use it, is what you're saying.
Well, they can't stay in business, so they have to sell their land to a large operator. And the operator continues to get larger and larger, so that you may have privately owned land, but it's owned by a huge outfit which bears no resemblance at all to the family farmer. So that's one thing. Now, the mechanism that's been used in North America is what's called the cost-price squeeze.
Mm-hmm. And this is what Wendell Berry said. The method used in the Soviet Union was the military, and the method used here in the United States is the free market, in which the richer are the freer, right?
That's right. Now, what happens is that you have a number of large companies right now which dominate the food industry at all ends and both sides. The costs that farmers have include their fertilizer and other inputs, the cost of their farm machinery, the cost of their land and the property tax on it. They have lots and lots of costs, and those costs continually rise. I don't think they've ever stopped or even slackened in the past 50 years, while at the same time the prices that farmers would get at the farm gate for their product has gone down and down. And anybody that knows anything at all about basic economics, if your costs are continually rising and your revenues are continually dropping, sooner or later you're going to get caught in a whipsaw and it's going to put you out of business.
So what's the difference then? I mean, how do farmers survive with subsidies, right?
Well, it depends. In Canada, we don't have subsidies anywhere near as high as the ones in the States. But what's happened is most small growers find it almost impossible to stay in business. So they just give up and sell out, and they leave. And we've gone from a population of 70% in agriculture to 2% or less because of this. Now, once they leave and their land is taken over by large operators, the large operators reorganize it on the same kind of industrial scale that the Soviets did. One of the most common is to use what's called monocropping, where you pick the one or two most profitable crops and you plant only those crops on your land.
Right.
In Saskatchewan, for example, it's wheat. In Idaho, it's corn. And in California, tomatoes and citrus fruits. But what you do is you concentrate. In the old days of the small family farms, farmers would rotate their crops from one field to another.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't put corn in a field and just keep it there year after year after year, because the corn would suck all the nitrogen out of the field and they'd have a lousy crop after a while.
So what they would do is rotate.
And plant beans or alfalfa or some legume crop in there to put the nitrogen back in. And this was normal on a small farm, and a small farmer could afford to do it. The large farm wants to maximize profit at any cost. And if the highest priced crop happens to be hybrid corn or tomatoes, they're going to plant nothing but corn and nothing but tomatoes on that land year after year in the same field. And you can't do that and keep up the fertility of that soil unless you really pour on the fertilizer. So right away you're adopting an industrial method. You consolidate the land into larger and larger blocks and introduce monocropping, where you concentrate on only one or two high yield and high profit crops.
Right.
And the result is that over the years, the land gets ruined from the standpoint of fertility. And also, it creates a terrific erosion problem.
Are you saying that the same thing that happened to Stalin's agriculture is happening to our agriculture as a consequence of this industrialization?
In terms of the effect on the fertility of the soil, on the surrounding environment, in terms of the quality of the crop, yes.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about the disappearance of the farmer, both here in the United States and throughout the Americas, actually. And we're seeing if it can be compared to what happened in the Soviet Union with Joseph Stalin. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to go to the phones when we get back, so please do stay tuned.
Get this.
The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
You know, between 1930 and the year 2000, about 27 million people left farm country for the city here in the United States. Many more millions in Canada and Mexico are doing the same. What happened to those farmers? Were they forced off the land in some Stalin-like purge, or were they simply, they had to leave because as a consequence of a better way of farming? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson here. We've got Tom Pollock, the author of The End of Food, and Cyril Vitomsky, host of the Embassy of the New World Order radio program. And you, we're going to go to the phones right now. We're going to start with Mark. Mark, welcome to the food chain.
Hey, Michael. Thank you very much, and hello to your guests. I have a kind of a perspective on this, and I agree somewhat with the author's thesis, but what I think is most injurious to farmers in our country and their ability to remain competitive is government intervention into farming practices at all levels. And when you find that we have very strict regulations that other countries and their farmers don't have to follow.
That's why our agriculture is moving offshore.
Yeah, it's why it moves offshore. And I also think that there is, you know, a situation where, the bigger the operation, the lower the cost in producing it. But I think that's also complicit with government policy, and it's an aberration of the free market. And I'll give you a perfect example. I know an apricot grower in San Benito County, and we were talking about the apricot market in California and the U.S., and I said, you know, I go in the store, I can't find any dried apricots grown in California, you know, unless I want to pay, like, you know, I want to buy organic ones and I want to pay a premium, but I can't find a competitively priced dried
right.
apricot. And he said, well, you know, all the dried cots come from Turkey, and they come in with a 1% tariff, and it costs the Turks 99 cents a pound to produce that. It cost me $4 a pound to produce dried apricots. And the reason why our government won't raise the tariff or level the playing field is because they want missile sites and flyover rights in Turkey. So constantly the State Department will bargain away agriculture, whatever advantages we might have in agriculture production, for other things that the government wants. And Michael, because farmers are 1% of the population, if you screw the farmer, you're not going to lose an election. And so the farmers get dumped on every time, you know, the government wants to do something in another country, they want some advantage, they're always willing to trade away access into our markets, and they're always willing to put the hurt on American farmers in order to achieve some other goal, because, you know, the farmers, numerically, they're not very many. And when you talk about, you know, less and less farmers, I find in my discussions with men and women at farm and in this area is that it's getting so tough for them. That's why they get out. And I remember that the California Farm Bureau, Michael, did a survey in 2003.
Mark, let
me finish this up real quick.
Okay, finish up.
Okay. In 1973, the average age of the California farmer was 34. In 2003, the average age was 58.
Yeah. There you go. You brought up a real interesting point that I wanted to follow up on, and thank you very much for your call,
sure,
Mark.
Sure.
And that is the political power of the farmer. I mean, at one time here in the United States, there were a lot of farmer voters, and now there are, what, 1 or 2%? Similarly, so now they have become politically insignificant. Was that a consideration of Stalin when he got rid of the farmers, the kulaks,
no.
the successful farmers?
It wasn't. And, well, he never cared about voting.
Oh, there you go.
So that wasn't in any way a relative thing. But
at least
but,
it was worries.
Yeah.
Right. But my question to would have been to Mark is, would you rather pay $1.50 for dried apricots or $4.50?
There you go. How about you, Tom? What is your response to Mark's
Well,
point?
I think the farmer right now, the small family farmer, is getting a very, very low price at the farm gate for what they produce. And it's not right. I hate to say this because consumers won't like it, but the truth is food is underpriced. And that's one of the reasons why the cost-price squeeze continues. But in terms of government policy, I never made the point about how that was accomplished in the States. There was a government policy which looked at the way this cost-price squeeze was working and realized that the large businesses which were causing the cost-price squeeze had a lot of money to contribute to campaign funds, and had a lot of lobbyists in Washington. And as far back as the Nixon administration, it was decided that as a deliberate government policy, the family farm should be wiped out. And the one who first implemented it was Earl Butz.
Right. Now you're using the same words as deliberately wiping out. That's almost synonymous with a purging them, right? I mean,
I think it is. Butz used to say, get bigger, get out. And he wanted everybody to sell up their farms and consolidate them into larger and larger units and organize them on an industrial model, a mass production model.
Let's go to Dan, who has a comment about parity and how parity might fit in with this notion. Dan?
Hi, Michael.
You're going to have to figure out how to explain that one really quick.
No. I'm just going to... quote Charles Walters. I am a retired computer programmer. I have my ancestors are pretty much all from ag, and I've been dabbling with organic gardening since 1969 and reading up. I started with Organic Magazine.
Well, tell us about parity and how parity fits in with here, because we have a whole bunch of callers here that want to talk as well.
Oh, okay. Tom can explain it, but. It's simply that the farmers should be entitled, but they used to be entitled to a fair price based on their actual cost.
Oh.
And when that was done away with, everything went into a decline.
Okay, that's a great one to pick up when we come back from this break. Are farmers entitled to a fair price? There you go. No? Okay. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Dan, thank you for the comment. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've got Tom Pollock, author of The End of Food, Cyril Vitomsky, host of the Embassy of New World Order. We're going to come right back and answer the question, should farmers get what they're entitled to in terms of their costs? That's an awfully interesting question. What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Holy smokes, we're back already. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We've got a quick question on the table. Should farmers be entitled to get a fair price for what they sell in terms of what it costs them to grow? Cyril, what do you think?
I don't think that they should. I think that they should be entitled to have an opportunity to reduce their cost to reflect the price that people are willing to pay.
Tom, what do you think?
I think people should consider what that low price is costing them. If you have to cheapen the product and cut corners in order to maintain an artificially low price, it may be that the consumer is losing a lot more than they really think. For example, the quality of produce that comes out of this system is continually declining. we've lost as much as 100% of the vitamin A in our potatoes, more than almost 60% of the vitamin C in potatoes. We've lost nearly 37% of the vitamin C in tomatoes, at the same time that the amount of toxic contaminants is climbing. So if the industrial method forces you to cheapen the product or destroy the product, and to cut corners that not only cheapen the product but also destroy the natural environment, destroy the soil, and ruin rural communities, is this really efficient?
Okay.
Or is it maintaining an artificially low price at an overall price to society that's far too high?
Okay, and Brandy, what are your comments about industrialized farming?
Well, I live in the Salinas area, so I'm kind of in a big industrial farming area, maybe less so than in the Midwest. But in some of my recent reading, it's come to my attention that a lot of our industrial farming is based on inexpensive fossil fuels, mainly petroleum. As that resource becomes more scarce and therefore more expensive, obviously our food is going to become more expensive. I think Americans have gotten used to having everything as inexpensive as possible, and while that's been great for those of us who've lived through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and obviously through now, our kids, when they're 30, 40, 50, aren't going to have it near as easy or near as inexpensively.
Well, there you go. Certainly something to think about. Randy, thank you so much for making your comment on the food chain. Let's go quickly to Rory. Rory, thanks for tuning in.
You bet. I think our efficiencies, and they're natural that you're going to become efficient, drive up the productivity, which drives down the price. So we're kind of victims of our own success in some ways. Many of the farmers in the area that we're in, Watsonville, Salinas Valley, you know, they would say, oh, that's an industrial monoculture system, but a lot of them are family farmers.
Right.
And they're struggling because the price of their commodity has dropped so much, and they're not making the money, so they got to control volume.
And that's
the other thing is, I would challenge the author there that you're driving down the nutritional quality of food and driving up toxins. I would challenge him on that. Where is he getting his data on that? Because most of the produce in California is absolutely pesticide free. The amount of any residue that's left over is either undetectable or negligible. And the nutritional quality of fruits and vegetables is quite high. So I would challenge that notion that we're destroying the soil, ruining the environment. I mean, that's hogwash. I mean, our challenge out here is to keep the insects in balance. And there's certainly plenty of life out here on the farm.
Rory, thank you so much for making your call.
Oh, one other
really
thing,
quickly,
Michael?
Real quickly.
Yeah. How do you account for people that were raised in the city and are out working on the farms like myself?
There you go. Good boy.
Take care. I'd like to comment on the source of the data.
Please do. We're running out of time, Tom.
Okay. It's from the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thank you very much.
Every year they publish food, not every year, but every couple of years they publish food tables.
Okay. How do we get in touch with you, Tom? Do you have a website?
No, I don't. You just have to buy the book.
Okay, The End of Food. You'll Google that and you'll find Tom. Cyril, how do we get in touch with you?
CyrilVatomsky.com, CYRILL.
Two L's?
Two L's and then the Y in the end.
Okay. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in to The Food Chain. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.